What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Future Proof Extra from News Talk.
Now, for centuries, philosophers have theorized about the mind-body question. Is our mind something separate from the body we live in? If so, what does that mean for who we are? And how does the brain conjure something as ephemeral as consciousness? Well, Anil Seth is Professor of Cognitive and Computational Neuroscience at the University of Sussex. He's Editor-in-Chief of Neuroscience of Consciousness. And he's got a new book out. It's called Being You, A New Science of Consciousness. He joins me now. Anil, you're probably the best placed person for me to ask my burning questions about consciousness. But let's start off, before we go down that rabbit tunnel, as some of the listeners are probably well familiar with them. What is consciousness as we define it in a scientific way?
That's a really good place to start. Consciousness is, well, we're all very familiar with what it is at one level. Consciousness is what you lose when you fall into a dreamless sleep or have general anesthesia. And it's what you regain when you come around again. A scientific, fully consensus definition of consciousness. Well, that's surprisingly hard to find. My favorite definition comes from the philosopher Thomas Nagel, who said that for a conscious organism, there is something it is like to be that organism. I mean, there's something it's like to be me. There's something it's like to be you. There's probably something it's like to be a bat or an elephant, but there's probably nothing it's like to be a table, a chair, or an iPhone. There's just nothing going on for those things. So consciousness, very broadly, is any kind of subjective experience whatsoever.
But what about plants then? Do plants have a sense of who they are, a consciousness?
I doubt it very much. Consciousness, as well as being positively about subjective experience, you can also say what it isn't. So it's not just the same thing as sensitivity to an environment. Plants, they're incredibly interesting and rich. And I've just been fascinated by recent work showing how trees communicate in forests and exchange nutrients in the wood wide web and all this brilliant stuff. But just interacting with an environment is not enough for consciousness. It doesn't mean there's something going on. It seems to me, at least, and I think most people would agree, that a minimum condition for consciousness is having a nervous system, having neurons, having some kind of brain in the right state.
You call it a controlled hallucination, that the way we perceive the world, our consciousness, is sort of a controlled hallucination. What do you mean by that?
I don't mean that it's all made up, that everything is just in your head. So hallucination is a bit of a tricky word. What I'm trying to emphasize here is that the world we experience, how we perceive what's really out there, that's an internal construction. So it's not that our eyes and our ears and our senses provide some transparent window out onto the external, objective, real world. There's a real world there, but our brain is constantly estimating it. It's constantly building a perception of it by using sensory signals. So the control is just as important as the hallucination here. Our experiences of the world come from within, like hallucinations, but they're controlled by sensory data that comes from the world, so that our perceptions have a grip on reality. Of course, they have to, otherwise we wouldn't survive very long.
There is this thing that sort of rang a bell with me when I read the book. This, I don't know where I picked it up, so maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't. This idea that we have this idea as humans that we are happy and then we smile. But actually that effect can be reversed, that we can smile and make ourselves happier. And I can't remember what it was, but I remember being struck by the idea of it, and that it was not something, it wasn't just wishy-washy. They you know, they measured stress hormones, they measured, you know, hormones in the brain. And it seemed to suggest that our feelings are not necessarily a product of our our emotional state or our physical state, and vice versa. I mean, does that pose any questions for consciousness?
I think it's a very interesting part of it. And the point that you raised, this idea about how much smiling might relate to happiness, there is, I think, two ways to look at that. There is a slightly wishy-washy way. There's this sort of idea that if you stick a pencil in your mouth so that it forces you to smile, then you just feel happier. That kind of stuff, I think, really is a bit wishy-washy. Mm. But the deeper truth underlying that is how emotion works in general. And what I explore in the book, and actually a lot of the work that I've been doing over the last 10 years or so, has been trying to understand emotion as a kind of perception too. It's a very old idea. It goes back to William James in the 19th century. But my take on it, my sort of new take on it, is that emotion works in just the same way that our perception of the outside world works too. It's another kind of controlled hallucination. When I experience visually a red car across the road, my brain is making a best guess about the causes of all the light that hits my eye. And it best guess is that it's a red car. When I feel an emotion, what's happening is that my brain is making a best guess. It's making an estimate of what caused the sensory signals that come from within the body. It's a perception of the physiological condition of the body. Hmm. So the example that William James gives is that it's all about grizzly bears. I don't really know how common grizzly bears
are. It's grizzly bears or saber-toothed tigers. If we're ever talking about like humans and emotions and evolution, those two things pop up all the time.
Exactly, exactly. But just imagine you see a grizzly bear and you feel afraid, and your body also starts to alter. It gets itself ready to run away or to fight. Adrenaline starts coursing through your blood. Your blood pressure rises. You might think that it's the sight of the bear that causes the emotion, and the emotion causes the changes in the body that then allow you to run away. But what James says, and what I think is going on too, is that you see the bear and immediately your body changes. Adrenaline starts coursing and so on. And it's the perception of those changes in the body that is the emotion of fear. And it's built by the brain in exactly the same way, through this controlled predictive perception, as are our experiences of the outside world.
So what you're suggesting is that emotion is just the word we put on a category of physical feelings, in a way.
It is, I think so, yeah. It's I would say it's the word we use for a category of perceptions that are very closely tied to the state of the body and to an evaluation the brain is making about basically the prospects for continuing to stay alive. Things feel good or bad in emotion. You know, well, I think emotion's a bit more complicated than that, but very broadly, emotion has valence. Things feel good or bad now and are likely to be good or bad in the future. And that's the perceptual content of an emotion, in exactly the same way that redness and location and shape are the perceptual contents of a visual experience.
In the book, you talk about some of your own experiments. I want you to maybe tell us about how you do explore reality, perception, and consciousness in experimental neuroscience.
There's many ways to do it, and they range from the rigorous but rather dull sorts of experiments where we just put volunteers in front of computer screens and they look at images or simple stimuli like flashes of light or dots for thousands of times, and we get them to make decisions about what they see, and we can measure what's happening in their brains, or we can just measure what they say they see or which buttons they press. You can find out a lot that way. There are newer approaches too, which are less controllable, maybe less precise, but really exciting in the possibilities they offer. We've been using virtual and augmented reality now for a number of years to get out of the lab and into the wild in a way where we can still actually do experiments. Because with VR, we can give people fully immersive experiences. We can also recreate aspects of their own body in a virtual space, so we can start studying how people experience the object in the world that they feel is their body. Mm. And then we can also couple these things with all the fancy tools of neuroimaging and look at what's actually happening in the brain that underlies these sorts of experiences.
Yeah, we had Balan Jalal on the program doing some work on sort of extension of the rubber hand trick, where he was getting people to put on virtual reality headsets and see tiny bodies. And it's amazing how quickly we sort of, our proprioception is, our sense of who we are is able to suddenly say, oh, well, it turns out I'm the size of a Barbie doll now, and this is my body. And it shows how, one of the things about those experiments, you know, that you can put someone inside a VR headset and they can start to feel like their body is something completely different and in a different place, is it makes me think that our sense of self is very fluid and actually very easily toppled over. Would you agree with that? That our sense of who we are, even physically, but also, you know, consciously.
Absolutely, I would. I think that's one of the main implications of a lot of this work, and not only experimental neuroscience, but also psychiatry and neurology. All the books of Oliver Sacks that I read when I was much younger just show the precarity of what a self is. But just on that point about this thing called the rubber hand illusion, which is this very famous illusion whereby you can trick people into feeling that a fake hand is somehow part of their body. Actually, that's something that in my lab with my colleagues, Peter Lush and Zoltan Dienes, we've been studying a lot in the last couple of years. And the story's changed dramatically. I now think of it very differently. The thing about the rubber hand illusion and its extensions is that people actually know what they're expected to feel implicitly, what they're expected to experience in something like that. You can think about it. You put a fake hand in front of someone, you stroke their hand with a paintbrush, you stroke the fake hand with a paintbrush at the same time, and you ask them, oh, does that feel like your hand?
Mm.
It's pretty clear what's supposed to happen. And then for a lot of people, it depends how suggestible you are. There's this stable personality trait of hypnotic suggestibility. For people that are quite high on it, they'll start to have that experience.
Wow.
And the reason they're having
it's a suggested effect.
It's a suggestion effect, or rather all the evidence out there so far is compatible with it just being a suggestion effect. Now, this doesn't mean it's not real. It is real. And it still speaks to this observation that the experience of selfhood is very flexible. But a lot of it might be down to how suggestible we are. Hmm. And this is actually a big challenge that we're facing in the study of consciousness, too. Because a lot of our experiments, of course, they're about changing people's experience and seeing what happens. And we've got to be very careful about suggestion effects, about leading people implicitly to know what experience we're hoping they have.
It is very hard to work with human experience and come out with a result that is reliable and untainted and reveals something of us, would you say? I mean, in the studies that you see in your journal, your colleagues' work, is it very difficult to say anything for certain?
It's always very difficult to say anything for certain in science. In psychology in particular, I think many people will have heard of the replication crisis. There's a lot of results which, with the benefit of hindsight and better statistics and better methods, just don't stand up. I mean, this is not to besmirch past work. It's just that we've got better ways of doing things now, and a lot of things do need to be revisited. Yeah, it's a big challenge, but science is never necessarily going to be easy. It's still easier than, let's say, quantum physics or sending people to Mars and so on. It just means that if you just have 20 people and you ask them some questions, you're probably not going to find out anything particularly reliable.
Well, the book is filled with lots of reliable stuff. That's a good segue, isn't it? It's rather clumsy. It's called Being You, author and neuroscientist Anil Seth. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure.